the tape recorder. My name is Paul Olson, and I'm an English teacher at Augustana College in Rock Island. And this is Holden Village, and we're going to talk about Sophie's Choice, a novel by William Styron. I asked before a lot of you got here, how many people have read this book or seen the movie? Lots of you. The reason I asked that is that there's certain things to read that would absolutely give away the plot, and I've been scolded by my students soundly. When I get to teach this novel, I've always shown a documentary of the making of the movie, because it interviews Styron a lot. It interviews Meryl Streep, Kevin Kline, Peter McNichol, Marvin Hamlisch, who wrote the music, which is incredible, for the movie. And you know the movie, Meryl Streep won the Academy Award for Best Actress. The movie gives away, of course, all the information, all the choices, and the ultimate choice that Sophie makes. And I showed it before we were done with the book. Don't ever do that. What did you do to my book? I thought we'd start with what I think. This is a wonderfully complex novel. There are people in American literature, I happen to be one of those, who thinks that this is the greatest American novel written. I would defend that against Moby Dick and Huckleberry Finn and The Sound of the Fury, and you name the books that kind of get the classic reputation of the greatest novels. I think this is there. You don't have to agree with that, it doesn't matter. But one of the reasons it gets that status, I think, is that it's very complex. It has lots of themes and complex characters that are developed beautifully and brilliantly. So how do you cover that in less than an hour? I thought we'd maybe focus on just one major theme that runs through the novel, and that's the theme of the human journey. And I've written it up here in a couple different ways. That idea is biblical as well. And we know that the Hebrew people, the whole thing starts in the Garden of Eden. And you can characterize Eden in lots of ways, and without discussing that in depth, one of the ways we could discuss it is the period, it's the place of innocence. These people don't even know when they're naked. It takes, eating the apple or the fruit. I think it was a banana, but Renaissance artists say apple. They eat the fruit, and then they know, and then they realize they're naked, and God even has to ask them, who told you? And you also know the story that you'll become like us and know the difference between good and evil. Well, in that biblical story, I think it's significant that when God sends the people out of Eden, it's God who puts the cherubim, the flaming sword, to block them from going back. I think about that, as I'll get to this in just a second, as William Blake does, perhaps, that once we are out of this Eden, we can't go back. And it's just part of the human journey. Life will never be as simple as it was for these people in Eden. And then they wander in the wilderness, the Hebrew people. And when they're in the wilderness, David mentioned it in one of his sessions. I know it was mentioned in the Bible study. I know that Jeannie mentioned it in her look at the Wheel of Life. People don't like to be in the wilderness. And the Hebrew people, just in Exodus, let alone Numbers and Deuteronomy as well, but in Exodus they say three times, they say, Moses, shouldn't have done this. I'm paraphrasing. We were better off back in the flesh pots of Egypt, where we knew where our next meal was coming from and what we would have to do. The wilderness experience is tough. But it seems as though only by going through the wilderness, and God tells them that, right? You have to do this first to get to the promised land. William Blake, a 19th century and late 18th century English poet, has a whole series of poems that are about this, and in his language says that the human journey is from innocence to experience, and unless we get there, we can't possibly reach this higher innocence. I'm just giving you some language for this journey that our narrator in Sophie's Choice is going to take. Other language to put that is that Eden and this innocence is the place of certainty. I just know that if I do this and do this, I'm okay, and everything's certain, and I don't want to have to wrestle with uncertainty. We've heard that in just about every session that we've encountered this week. Certainty, but then comes doubt. But without doubt, it's Dostoevsky who calls doubt the necessary minus. Without doubt, there can be no faith, because then we're just brainwashed and where everything's certain and easy. I'm sure my writing is getting hard to read and it's just small. We used to have a bigger whiteboard. It's their fault, not mine. I wouldn't be a slob if it weren't for that. I think Styron, and I think Milton as well, John Milton, the great English poet, there's this stage of, I've written these in the wrong order, this unconsciousness that goes on in Eden, and then a consciousness, a rise to consciousness, and only through that can we finally understand truth. Another way to look at that, and now we'll get to Sophie's Choice, is that Styron himself, as most of you, almost all of you, said you've read the book or seen the movie. I'll read for a second in a second from the beginning of the novel. Styron uses the phrase that I have been landlocked. And landlocked is this unconsciousness, this certainty, this innocence, this Eden. And he has to go on a journey. And this journey is with this woman he meets in an apartment house that he shares with about seven other people. And he meets Sophie, who is, as you know, a survivor of the Holocaust in Auschwitz. He's never been there before. And now I'm kind of mixing, not metaphor, mixing authors. Styron would say the soul is landlocked, but it has to go on a journey. And John Milton would say, only until that happens can somebody possibly be virtuous. And one of the poems by Milton, it's a different kind of genre than poetry, it doesn't matter though. It's Comus, and this woman, I'm oversimplifying, wants to meet her betrothed in the woods for some kind of a picnic or gathering, and her brothers don't want her to go because she'll lose her chastity, and apparently 17th century chastity was a lot more important than it is in the 20th century. But don't go out there because you will lose your chastity, and then she gets in a discussion about what virtue is, and the line that would come from Milton is, virtue untested isn't virtue. Virtue untested is, and she says, well, of course, you can keep me virtuous and chaste if you just lock me up in a jail, but I'm not good, therefore. We have to have, it's the necessary minus. Does all that make sense? Okay, let's go right to Sophie's Choice and give you the language that comes from Styron. Now, I'll just refresh your memory. The story, does anybody want to give a quick summary that can do this, or should I do it? I'll do it. Just to save us time. Because your quick summary might not be as quick as mine. Stingo is the speaker in the whole poem. He's the narrator. And I have met William Styron several times. And I asked him, who's Stingo? He said, that's me. Well, then who's Nathan? Well, that's me too. Well, who's Sophie? That's me too. And then I said, well, okay, then how much of this is autobiographical? And, for example, in the beginning of the novel, Stingo, who is Styron, gets a job with McGraw-Hill. Styron had a job with McGraw-Hill. They fire him from McGraw-Hill, the publishing company. Styron got fired from McGraw-Hill. Stingo was writing a novel about a woman who commits suicide. Styron wrote a novel, Lie Down in Darkness, about a woman who commits suicide and the dysfunctional family she came from and the torture to her soul that was caused by all that. Stingo was going to work on a novel about a slave revolt. Styron wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel called The Confessions of Nat Turner. So he is Stingo often. Then Stingo meets Sophie in this apartment complex. And he's first taken away with her physical beauty. And he has a couple of great lines about that, and Styron, who is the quintessential Southern gentleman, says that my own behavior has to be perfect so I can say anything I want in a novel. And he does. There's explicit sex scenes in the novel. If you haven't read it, if you have, you know that. And that's all he wants from Sophie, is that just a night in the sack with her would be the best thing of all, until he sees her just a couple days later. He looks at this physical beauty, and then he's sitting beside her in a discussion, and he sees a number tattooed on her arm. And everything begins to change. He grabs her wrist and says, "Where were you?" And no longer can he have this, I'm going to call it, this pornographic look at Sophie, that all she is a sex object. Now she begins to come on this road of being a complex human being. Where were you? What have you been through? And then that's his whole journey toward understanding the difference between good and evil, and we'll get into that as we go. So, here's what Stengel says about his story. He's moved into this apartment in Manhattan, or not in Manhattan, in New York, and everything but Manhattan. And he says, "I wanted beyond hope or dreaming to become a writer." Because he had just listened to a story about one of his colleagues, about his son. The colleague's son was shot in Okinawa the day before Stengel went there on a reconnaissance trip. In other words, it's just kind of an absurd. Stengel was lucky. So this story that he heard about this kid that was killed just the day before he had been there struck deeply at his heart. And then listen to this. "I was aware of the large hollowness I carried within me. It was true that I had traveled great distances for one so young. But my spirit had remained landlocked." And here's what landlocked means to him. "Unacquainted with love and all but a stranger to death. I could not realize then how soon I would encounter both of these things, that is love and death, embodied in the human passion and human flesh from which I had absented myself in my smug and airless self-deprivation. Nor did I then realize that my voyage of discovery," that's the journey, "that my voyage of discovery would also be a journey to a place as strange as Brooklyn. Meanwhile, I only knew that I would go down for the last time from the 20th floor," he's gotten fired from his job, "riding the aseptic green elevator to the chaotic Manhattan streets, and there celebrate my deliverance with expensive Canadian ale and the first sirloin steak I had eaten since coming to New York." He's going to celebrate this move out of all of this into from the 20th floor down into Manhattan. Well, I'm skipping quickly, and you can stop me anytime. If you say, "I need the context for that," I'll be happy to provide that. He meets Sophie, and I later learned he was joking, but I didn't know it the first time. I had been discussing with colleagues for really a few years about teaching Sophie's Choice. I think it's got to be in the canon, it's got to be in the curriculum, what are we doing not teaching it? And they said it's too long, and one colleague said it's just a book about sex and drugs anyway. He was kidding, but I didn't know that, and I thought the guy's nuts. He meets Sophie, and you tell me if anyone could possibly think this is a book about sex and drugs. She's just begun to tell her story of her survival and her escape. First her survival, and then by escape I mean into a Swedish refugee camp, and then over to New York and trying to recover her sense of self. "So, Stengel, I have lived long with this very, very strong guilt, which I can't lose. Even though I know it has no reason, like that Jewish woman in Sweden said when she tried to make me see that the love we had," and what she's referring to is she had a fight with her husband the day before the Nazis took him and killed him. And this turns out to be a lie. She didn't really, that's another story, I guess. She didn't really love her husband much anyway. He was an abusive jerk. But she tells all these stories to lift herself out of all kinds of guilt. And I'll explain that as we go too, that she has. So she's not only a survivor and living with her, you all know the phrase, right? Survivor's guilt, why me? But she also participated in ways in the Holocaust that contributed to the death of millions. And we'll see how that goes too. But so she says, "I have this guilt." And then how it's changed her. And she says, "I have this strong guilt. Funny, Stengel, you know I have learned to cry again, and I think perhaps that means I am a human being, maybe. Perhaps that at least, a piece of a human being. But yes, a human being. Often I cry alone when I listen to music, which remind me of Krakow in those years past. She's Polish, she grew up in Krakow, she was almost a concert-level pianist, and for sure loved to listen to classical music. And she says, "And you know, there's one piece of music that I cannot listen to. It makes me cry so much my nose stops up. I cannot breathe, my eyes run like streams. It is in these Handel records I got for Christmas. I know that my Redeemer liveth, that make me cry because of all my guilt, and also because I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God." She's quoting directly out of the soprano aria, "I know that my Redeemer liveth, and though worms destroy my body, yet in my flesh will I see God." And she can't even listen to that song. So this is a story, this is on page 93. This is early in the novel, when we learn that this woman has lost so much, we don't know what. But one of the things we know early is that she's lost her faith. And that we'll learn, as you know the story, we'll learn that she loses a father, she loses a mother, she loses a husband, and she loses a best friend, and she loses two children. And on this goes, but maybe most of all, she's looking for some way to expiate this guilt and to deal with this, not just sorrow, but even the anguish is the word. And it seems as though she thinks God is the only way. But listen again. "I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God." I'm going to skip up and then go back. In their apartment house is a guy named Morris Fink. And he's kind of a gossip and kind of a Dumkopf. Stingo comes home one day, and by now he's befriended both Sophie and her lover, who lives, they live in separate rooms, but they're in the apartment, and he hears them, as he says, humping all the time. He's come home, and Sophie and Nathan are gone. They've had terrible fights, and finally they just split. They're gone. Both of them. They finally cut out for good. "What do you mean, for good?" That's Stingo. And he's devastated because he's such good friends. "Just what I said. Finished for good. Gone for good. And I say good riddance. There was something creepy, I mean sick, about this house with that golem Nathan. All that fighting and screaming. Good riddance, if you want to know." I felt desperation edging my voice as I demanded, "But where did they go? Did they tell you where they were going?" "No. They went in two directions." "Two directions? Do you mean?" "I'd seen them come back in the house about 2 hours ago, just when I was walking up the street. I'd went out to a movie. Already he was howling at her like a gorilla. I said to myself, oh, another fight already, after all these weeks when it was quiet. Now I gotta maybe try to save her again from this Meshbugner. Then when I get to the house here, I see that he's making her pack up. I mean, he's in his room, see, packing his own things. And she's in the other room, packing hers. And all the time he's hollering at her like a madman. Oi! What dirty things he calls her. And Sophie? Yeah, and she. She's crying her eyes out the whole time. The two of them packing her things and him screaming and calling her a whore. And Sophie bawling like a baby. It made me sick." He paused, took a swallow of air, then resumed more slowly. "I didn't realize that they were packing to leave for good. Then he looked down over the railing and seen me and asked where Yetta was." That's who owns the apartment place. "I said she was over in Staten Island. He threw me down $30 for rent, Sophie's and his, and I realized they were out for good. I tell you, they went in two different directions. They get their stuff all packed finally and go downstairs. This was only about 20 minutes ago. Nathan gives me a buck to help bring the baggies down, also to take care of the phonograph. Says he'll come back and get it later, along with some boxes. When I come back with the taxi, he's still hollering at her. And I say to myself, well, at least this time he didn't hit her or nothing. But he's still hollering at her. About Auschwitz, mainly. Something like Auschwitz." "About what?" "About Auschwitz. That's what he says. Call her a whore again and ask her this weirdo question over and over. Ask her, how did you live through Auschwitz, he said. What did he mean by that?" "Called her what?" I faltered helplessly, nearly bereft of speech. "Then what?" "And he gave her $50. It looked like about that. and told the driver to take her someplace in New York, Manhattan, some hotel, I think. I can't remember where. He said something about how happy he'd be never to have to see her again. I'd never heard anyone cry like that. Sophie was crying then. Anyway, after she was gone, he put his own things in the other cab and left in the opposite direction up toward Flatbush Avenue. I think he must have went to his brother's in Queens. Gone then, I whispered, evilly stricken now. Gone for good. And good damn riddance, I say. That guy was a golem. But Sophie, I feel sorry for her. She was a real nice broad, you know? Yes, I said finally, I know. What's Auschwitz? Said Morris Fink. That's why Styron wrote the book. That's why Stingo has to tell the story. What is Auschwitz? And at the very end of the novel, Stingo looks back at his journal and says he wrote three things in that of those important days in his journal that are worth saving. And I'm going to come back to the other two, but the first one is, someday I will understand Auschwitz. That's what he had written, and then he makes a comment about it. This was a brave statement, but innocently absurd. No one will ever understand Auschwitz. What I might have set down with more accuracy would have been, someday I will write about Sophie's life and death, and thereby help demonstrate how absolute evil is never extinguished from the world. Auschwitz itself remains inexplicable. The most profound statement yet made about Auschwitz was not a statement at all, but a response. The query? At Auschwitz, tell me, where was God? And the answer? Where was man? So, Styron, Stingo, is going to take, not only go on this journey, but he's going to take us with him. And as readers, we learn through the explicit, specific story of Sophie what happened to 12 million people and how evil is organized and precipitated and perpetuated by common people who don't pay attention or who pay attention to the wrong things. And one of the phrases that I picked up, I don't even know if it's fair, but I do it, and I'll do it with you guys, is how do we distinguish between what is naughty and what is evil? And Stingo's questions over and over again, and a lot of them have to do with American morality about sex, that we've paid attention to the naughty, but for Stingo's words, we've ignored 6,000 Jews killed a day at Auschwitz. But we don't want our daughters making out in the backseat of a car. We don't. What he's talking about is where have we put our emphasis, what have we focused on, and what matters. And I think that's one of the reasons for a lot of the very specific, even anatomical sex scenes. As readers, we're disturbed by that, I think. Especially depends on how old you are. If you're a college student, you've read it a lot. I sent this book to my dad, who was the son of a Lutheran pastor. My dad lived to be 102, and in all those years that I was alive with him, I never once heard him say anything that would be other than jumpin' Jehoshaphat. That was as far as it ever went. I sent him this book. And imagine my shock when I said, Dad, how do you like Sophie's Choice? Well, there are a lot of fucks in it. I dropped the phone, I'm sure. There are a lot of fucks in it, but it's a great book. My point in telling you that story is the language, again, Styron shoots straight as an arrow in every way in his life. The language that throws that kind of language around and that kind of specific and sometimes vulgar, violent sex, Nathan is abusive verbally, sexually, emotionally to Sophie, we're disturbed by that. And I'm pretty sure that all writers want us to take the same journey that the characters take. And we're disturbed. And what is it that disturbs us? And we're disturbed by, did you see what that guy did? He stole a bottle of pop, I'm making things up now, out of the grocery store. but I'm sending pollutants down the river every day. Are you with me? And I'm not, those are just hypothetical examples, but this is what Stingo has to deal with now. How do I understand the difference between naughty and evil and good and evil, and what makes somebody, Milton's language, virtuous? Now I'll take you to the story. I already written the description of the of what I was going to discuss on the kiosk, and I went up to get my Sophie's Choice book, which has notes and underlining and everything in there, and I looked at the bookshelf. You know what? I think I left it at home. I said, that's only 1,700 miles. So I got a book out of the bookstore, and I haven't underlined it. So I might fumble a little bit, but I think I'll be okay. So just bear with me on that. Sophie begins to tell Stingo her stories in Auschwitz. I spent a lot of days and nights in the Gestapo prison. Then I was deported by train to Auschwitz. It take two, she speaks in an accent. It takes two complete days and a night to arrive there, although in normal times the train is only 6 or 7 hours. There were two separate camps at Auschwitz, the place called Auschwitz itself, and the camp a few kilometers away called Birkenau. There was a difference between the camps that one must understood, since Auschwitz was used for slave labor and Birkenau was used for just one thing, and that was extermination. When I come off the train, I was selected not to go to Birkenau. And to Sophie's chagrin, she felt the thin outer layer of her cool facade begin to shiver and crack, and her composure faltered. She was aware of a quirky quaver in her voice. She was stammering, but she quickly gained control of herself. One of the things Sophie does throughout, both the movie and the book, is that she has repressed her past and says often, but I won't talk about that. I cannot go there. In her apartment room, she has no pictures of her past, and she lies about her father. Here's a great, I think anyway, it was to me, story about how authors work. Sophie, for 200 pages, or 400 pages, lies to Stingo about her past. And she said, my father was a helper for the Jews. He loved the Jews, and he wanted to save the Jews, when in reality, he wrote a preliminary extermination law. And we learned that Sophie took that, she typed it for him and kept it in her boot in case she ever needed it to show the Germans if she got caught, hey, I'm on your side. And that's part of her guilt, and we'll come back to that. But she lied, as she was telling the story about how good her father was and what a savior of the Jews he was. And Styron took him 8 years to write Sophie's Choice. He writes with a pencil on a yellow legal pad. He doesn't rewrite. I can't remember what I wrote yesterday, let alone what I wrote 8 years ago. But he just continues on to this, and he's written for about 6 weeks, and he stopped, and he moved to Auschwitz and lived there for 3 weeks. And when I was visiting with him, we also had a German Holocaust survivor in the conversation in Rock Island, Illinois, who said to Styron, I have never read anybody capture the ethos of anti-Semitic Poland better than you did in Sophie's Choice. So he got something real out of this trip. Anyway, he came back and he stood there in front of the two of us and said, when I came back from Auschwitz, I realized, he pats his chest, Sophie had been lying to me. Think about who's in charge of the story. What characters take you away? And it leads us to a different truth that is bigger than just the historical research that a writer might do. did I see your hand? Okay. I was at Auschwitz for 20 months. When I arrived, everyone who was selected to be killed was sent to Birkenau. But very soon later, Birkenau became the place where only Jews were killed. It was a place for the mass extermination of the Jews. There was still another place not far away that made artificial rubber. The prisoners at the Auschwitz camp worked there too, but mainly there was one purpose for the Auschwitz prisoners, which was to help in the extermination of the Jews at Birkenau. So the camp at Auschwitz became mostly composed of what Germans called the Aryans, who worked to maintain the Birkenau crematoriums. I'll write a figure on the board here for you that I learned from a book. I'm from the book, I just forgot the title. 45,000 German civilians participated in the murder of Jews. 45,000 civilians. That'll become an important number as we go through and listen to Sophie's story. Well, Stingo has an assessment of her story, as he just heard that. That's just the first part of that. She's kind of just telling you the calendar, right? I was 20 months in Auschwitz. He's heard the story of Stingo that says, unknown then to Sophie or to the world in general, Rudolf Hess, who was the commandant at Auschwitz, in the months preceding his trial and execution, had been composing a document which, in its relatively brief compass, tells as much as any single work about a mind swept away in the rapture of totalitarianism. Years were to pass before its translation into English, done excellently by Constantine Fitzgibbons. And this becomes, in some lots of ways, an historical novel, too. Styron has done his research. Now bound into a volume called K.L. Auschwitz as Seen by the SS, published by the Polish State Museum, maintained today at the camp. This anatomy of Hess's psyche is available for examination by all those who might thirst for knowledge about the true nature of evil. K.L. Auschwitz, that's for confirmation, cramping German phrases. K.L. Auschwitz is Seen by the SS. It is a book that exists, and it's written by some of the people that ran the concentration camps, the SS people. Here's what Styron or Stingo says about that. This anatomy of Hess's psyche is available for examination if you want to know true evil. Certainly it should be read throughout the world by, now think of this journey, should be read throughout the world by professors of philosophy, ministers of the gospel, rabbis, shamans, all historians, writers, politicians, diplomats, liberationists of whatever sex and persuasion, lawyers, judges, penologists, stand-up comedians, film directors, journalists, in short, anyone concerned remotely with affecting the consciousness of his fellow man. And this would include our own beloved children, those incipient American leaders at the eighth grade level who should be required to study it, along with The Catcher in the Rye, The Hobbit, and The Constitution. For within these confessions, it will be discovered that we really have no acquaintance with true evil. The evil portrayed in most novels and plays and movies is mediocre, if not spurious. A shoddy concoction generally made up of violence, fantasy, neurotic terror, and melodrama. I'm looking for the page where Stingo comments on this. Real evil, the suffocating evil of Auschwitz, gloomy, monotonous, barren, boring, was perpetrated almost exclusively by civilians. Thus, we find that the roles of the SS at Auschwitz-Birkenau contained almost no professional soldiers, but were instead composed of a cross-section of German society. They included waiters, bakers, carpenters, restaurant owners, physicians, a bookkeeper, a post office clerk, a waitress, a bank clerk, a nurse, a locksmith, a fireman, a customs officer, a legal advisor, a manufacturer of musical instruments, a specialist in machine construction. The list goes on and on with these commonplace and familiar citizens' pursuits. There needs only to be added the observation that history's greatest liquidator of Jews, the thick-witted Heinrich Himmler, was a chicken farmer. Are we okay? Are you following the journey? Sophie, and Sophie doesn't know what to do. I'm sorry. What to do with her guilt. And Stego doesn't know what to do with his artistry. Do I dare write about this? And this is what he says. George Steiner remarks, George Steiner's a story, it is not clear, here's a quote from Steiner, that those who are not themselves fully involved should touch upon these agonies, unscathed. I have been, as an artist, haunted, I must confess, by an element of presumption in the sense of being an intruder upon the terrain of an experience so bestial, so inexplicable, so undetachably and rightfully the possession alone of those who suffered and died or survived it. A survivor, Elie Wiesel, has written, novelists made free use of the Holocaust in their work, and in doing so they cheapened it, drained it of its substance. The Holocaust was now a hot topic, fashionable, guaranteed to gain attention and to achieve instant success. As an artist, I do not know how ultimately valid any of this is, but I am aware of the risk. Styron wrote two books that were most famous. He's a white Southerner Gentile, and he wrote about slavery from the perspective of a slave, and the Holocaust from the perspective of a survivor. That's a risky thing to do. He's aware of that. And he says, however, yet I cannot accept, and this is where all people, he brings us into this, the readers as well, I can't accept Steiner's suggestion that silence is the answer. That it is best, and he quotes Steiner, not to add to the trivia of literary sociological debate to the unspeakable. Nor do I agree with the idea that in the presence of certain realities, art is trivial or impertinent. Almost cosmic in its incomprehensibility as it may appear, the embodiment of evil which Auschwitz has become remains impenetrable only so long as we shrink from trying to penetrate it, however inadequately. I have thought that it might be possible to make a stab at understanding Auschwitz by trying to understand Sophie. And we begin to understand Sophie as we listen to her talk about, I realized that almost the one single thing on earth that I did not want to be forced to do was to be implicated anymore with that pamphlet. She's typed it and she's carried it in her boot. And it makes me revolted to think that I must go around the university with a stack of these things. Her father says, spread these out through all the people, I want them to read it. It made me, the university, with a stack of these things, giving them to the professors, but just as my father said, Sophie will help you pass them out. I knew that I would be there with Kotzik, her husband, passing out these sheets just like I'd done everything he told me to do since I was a little girl, running these errands, bringing him things, learning to use a typewriter and knowing shorthand just so he could use me whenever he wanted. And this terrible emptiness come over me when I realized just then there was nothing I could do about it, no way of saying no, no way, no possible to say, Papa, I'm not going to help you spread this thing. But you see, Stengel, there is a truth. I must tell you that even now I can't understand or truly make clear. Because maybe it looked much better if I said I would not help pass out this thing of my father's just because I finally see he is saying in it, murder Jews. That was bad, I knew. Terrible. And even then I couldn't hardly believe this was actually what he had written. But it was becoming, well, but she does it anyway because she can't say no. And much later we learn how important this becomes to her. Thought I put a dot here. Sorry, hang on. She tells us that she carried this in her boot. Impetuously then, she knew it was a risk, a gamble. She bent down and fumblingly plucked the worn and faded pamphlet from the little device in her boot. There. she said, flourishing it in front of him, spreading out the title page. I've kept this against the rules. I know I've taken a chance, but I want you to know that these few pages represent everything I stand for. I know from working with you that the final solution has been a secret, but this is one of the earliest Polish documents suggesting a final solution to the Jewish problem. I collaborated with my father, whom I mentioned to you before, in writing it. Naturally, I don't expect you to read it in detail, filled with so many new worries and concerns as you are, but I do earnestly beg you to at least consider it. She's talking to an SS officer to save her neck. Here's a story that gets interjected at this time. That Stingo tries to, he's got a job, I mean, at school, after school, to come home and heat the furnace for his mother, who is dying of cancer. And he forgets to come home one night. And what we have in this novel is that we hear a story from Sophie that it's almost impossible to relate to. And then Stingo tells his own story. And we just heard about Sophie and this carrying this thing in her boot. And we hear about guilt that she feels, and this is what maybe one of the things that ultimately destroys her. Stingo has to come home to heat the fire, and one night he forgets. It was on a sofa in front of this fireplace that my mother lay reading on winter afternoons. As an only child, I was classically, though not immoderately, spoiled. One of the few chores demanded of me on afternoons after school during the winter months was that I hurry home and see to it that the fireplace was well-fueled, since although my mother was not yet totally incapacitated, it was far, far beyond her strength to throw wood on a fire. There was no telephone, but in an adjoining room downstairs, she could not negotiate. There was a telephone, but she couldn't get there. He forgets to come home, and when he does arrive home, the room bloomed with smoke from a smoldering log she had tried futilely to shove onto the fire with her cane. God knows what Eskimo ice floe visions had engulfed her when she sank back amid her bestsellers, all those bloated books of the month with which she had tried to barricade herself against death. Propped her leg up on the stool with the onerous two-handed hitching motion I remembered, and felt the rods of the metal brace slowly grow as chill as stalactites against that wretched, useless, carcinoma-riddled limb. When I burst through the doorway, I recollect one impression captured my soul so completely as to seem to envelop the room, her eyes. Those hazel, bespeckled eyes and the way that ravaged her, still terrified gaze caught my own, then darted swiftly away. Was the swiftness of that turning away, which would thereafter define my guilt. It was as swift as a machete dismembering a hand. And I realized with horror how much I resented her burdensome affliction. She wept then, and I wept, but separately, and we listened to each other's weeping as if across a wide and desolate lake. I am certain that my father, so ordinarily mild and forbearing, said something harsh, scathing. But it was not his words that I ever remembered, only the cold, the blood-congealing cold and darkness of the woodshed, where he marched me and where he made me stay until long after darkness fell over the village and frigid moonlight seeped into the cracks of my cell. How long I shivered and wept there, I cannot recall. I was only aware that I was suffering exactly in the same way that my mother had, and that my deserts could scarcely be more fitting. No malefactor ever endured his punishment with less rancor. I suppose I was incarcerated for no more than 2 hours, but I would willingly have stayed there until dawn, or indeed until I had frozen to death, so long as I was able to expiate my crime. This too is Sophie's issue. How can I get rid of this guilt that I participated in? I think what's best to do is take you to Sophie's biggest problem, and then we'll let you see what kind of questions you might want to ask. I'm skipping. She's asked to be involved. Come on, you can help us. You can read German. We can just get this radio for us. Do something. Somehow get involved. And she keeps saying, I can't. I have children. I can't do it. There comes a point in life where every human being must stand up and be counted. Wanda is the resistance movement, or a leader of it, and she wants her to get involved. Wanda was saying, you know what a beautiful person I think you are, and Joseph would die for you. Her voice rose now, began to scrape her raw. But you can no longer treat us this way. You have to assume responsibility, Sophie. You've come to the place where you can no longer fool around like this. You have to make a choice. Then there's a beautiful passage of her mind goes to the street where she hears children playing, and she thinks of her kids, and then she later wishes, that night I went up to tuck them into bed, and I thought of grabbing them both and jumping out the window. I wish I had done it, because at that time she didn't know what lay ahead for her children and for her. I'm going to get to one more thing, and then I hope we can pull together with your questions what we want to achieve with this. Her lover is unbelievably abusive. He kicks her in the ribs. When he gets her down on the ground, he urinates in her. He tries to, he can't do it. He calls her a whore. He bats her around, and worst of all, most of all, how did you survive? Why you and not others? And this eats away at her heart, and this is the guilt from which she can't find expiation. And she can't because mom can't fix this, dad can't fix this, friendship can't fix this. The only thing that can fix this is the God that she has left, the Redeemer that she knows doesn't live. Well, near the end of the novel, as you know, we find out that her lover is a schizophrenic. He's a paranoid schizophrenic, and he's on drugs, and he is crazy. But Stingo writes, or Stingo hears this news about Nathan, with whom now Stingo is very good friends, from Nathan's brother. And he has some interesting, it's just a short paragraph, when Larry tells Stingo that Nathan is insane. How can one, they like to get him away from Sophie, to protect her, but how can one prevent him from marrying her? If he were, and who is he really talking about here is why I'm reading this paragraph. If he were out and out uncontrollably insane, we would have to put him away forever. That would solve everything. But the terrible difficulty, you see, lies in the fact that there are these lengthy periods when he appears to be normal. And who is to say that one of these long remissions doesn't really represent what amounts to a complete cure? There are many such cases on record. How can you penalize a man and prevent him from living a life like everyone else by simply assuming the worst? Assuming that he will go completely berserk again when such might not be the case. And yet, suppose he marries that nice girl, and suppose they have a baby. Then suppose he really goes off his rocker again. How unfair that would be to, well, to everyone. After a moment's silence, he gazed at me with a penetrating look and said, I don't have any answer. Do you have an answer? Sometimes I think life is a hideous trap. Any ideas besides Nathan what that might refer to? Is sane most of the time, but then goes crazy. Is it an anti-war novel? What makes us go to war? What makes us do anything? Does everybody go crazy once in a while? And Nathan, we learn at the end of the book, when we learn that he's insane, he has a reason to be so crazy and to be so violent. The Nazis had no sickness. They are not paranoid schizophrenic. It was cold and deliberate, and the engineers sat around and just talked about if we make the walls of the furnaces 3 inches thicker, they can withstand hundreds of degrees more heat. Bodies will burn faster. Are they crazy? The novel keeps asking us that question. The novel doesn't end in despair, and I'm going to skip to that. And there's, you know, those of you who have read it or have seen the movie, you know what happens. But Stingo has an interesting thing that he wrote in his journal, and this is, we must hear this, because it's what gets us to through the end, of why it makes it, like all great literature, an affirmation of life. I read the one thing he wrote in his journal, remember that? Someday I'll understand Auschwitz. That's crazy, I won't. The second thing he wrote, then I wrote perhaps what is maybe the only bearable truth. And it's in italics, and he pulls it out of his journal. Let your love flow out on all living things. But there are a couple of problems about this precept of mine. The first is, of course, it's not mine. It springs from the universe and is the property of God. And the words have been intercepted on the wing, so to speak, by such mediators as Lao Tzu, Jesus, Buddha, and thousands upon thousands of lesser prophets, including your narrator, who heard the terrible truth of their drumming somewhere between Baltimore and Wilmington and set them down with the fury of a madman sculpting in stone. That's when I wrote it. 30 years later, they're still abroad in the ether. I heard them celebrated exactly as I've written them in a splendid twangy song played on a country music program when I drove to New England one night. But this brings us to the second problem, the words truth, or if not their truth, their impossibility. What's the line again? Let your love flow out on all living things. For did not, I'm going to draw a picture of this. He's going to give a metaphor that's worth remembering forever. He calls something titanic love. And it exists. And it flows through the bloodstream of mankind. But somebody built an embolism and stopped that love. I'll read it as Stingo discusses it. This brings us to the second problem, the words truth, not their truth, their impossibility. Did not Auschwitz effectively block the flow of that titanic love like some fatal embolism in the bloodstream of mankind? Or at least alter the nature of love entirely so as to reduce to absurdity, let your love flow out of all living things, to absurdity the idea of loving an ant or a salamander or a viper or a toad or a tarantula or a rabies virus or even blessed and beautiful things in a world which permitted the black edifice of Auschwitz to be built. I do not know. Perhaps it is too early to tell. At any rate, I have preserved those words as a reminder of some fragile yet perdurable hope. The last words I've kept from the journal comprise a line of poetry from my own. And I'll skip all of this. And he says this in his last journal, his last entry in his journal. He's writing this story 30 years later. He goes back to this journal from 30 years ago when he knew Sophie. And he wrote, "It was then that in my mind I inscribed the words, 'Neath cold sand I dreamed of death, but woke at dawn to see in glory the bright the morning star.'" And the novel ends with, "This was not judgment day, only morning, morning excellent and fair." My illustration for that is this. Sophie saw a world so full of evil that it just tipped the scales and she couldn't live it. So, the pills. Stingo says, "It's not judgment day. I am now aware. I am conscious. I have been on this journey. My soul is not landlocked. I know about death and I know about love. And it too exists. It's not judgment day. It's only morning, bright and fair." And he will live with a whole new kind of consciousness that was brought to him through this wilderness experience on his journey, is what he called his voyage of discovery. What do you want to ask? We got anything. Or say, you've seen the movie, you've read the book. Any comments? Is it full of despair? I would hate to teach a book that everybody would walk out of it, you know, my students. We spend an hour. I teach this for 3 weeks to students. And then they evaluate it at the end of the term anonymously. I have a handwriting analyst just to check, but they rate all the books in the course on a 1 to 10 scale. Sophie gets 99%, 10. But we have time with it. And they recognize that this journey is their journey, and it's our journey too. I didn't know that, but okay, enough for me. Anybody?
I have an experience of years of listening to an expression by my father. He was gassed in France and had been badly shot up in the First World War, suffered through a lot of agony with the depression and then the lingering death of my mother. And he would oftentimes say when I was living with him, and then after we brought him to the West Coast years later, live in hope and die in despair. And it's that kind of journey that I'm sure that must have been within this journey that these people had to take.
Well, when the hope is gone, Sophie did that. She died in despair. The affirmation in the book is dingo. I get that. Thank you. Others? I know you're thinking, your wheels are turning. Do we get, I don't know if you can in an hour, and especially the selections that I selected. Do we get that there can be affirmation out of this? And the affirmation is, we can't go back to not knowing. We can't say, what's Auschwitz, like Morris Fink did? What's pollution? What's racism? What's sexism? What's homophobia? Once we know, we can't go back. And the novel's about that. And this is Auschwitz. Who built it? What do you call it? Remember, this is a terrible question. This is the quiz, though. Here you are. This was called a human edifice.
Embolism.
It's an embolism. But this stopped up. And he called it, yeah. His metaphor was an embolism, but he later calls it, this is a human. Who built Auschwitz? Remember the question? Where was God? That's not the right question. Where was man? Once we know. No wonder, at least the way I read this story about the Milton calls it the rise of man, the fortunate fall. God doesn't want people back here. Don't go back there. We know there's been good and evil. Go out here and yeah, but that's the affirmation, I think. Well, you can go get ice cream if it's not too late, but I'd love to hear more comments from you, from your hearts, from your minds, from your anything. But you can also go. 9:30. I was going to ask if you'd read it. It's an unfair test. Interested in reading the book? Who's seen the movie but hasn't read the book? Okay. If you're a lover of language, I haven't read every novel ever written by an American, but I don't know a novelist that has better control and use of beautiful language. Fred Niebuhr read this book over a two-week period and called me after he finished, you know, our Bible study here, called me after he finished and said, I wish you'd never suggested that, because every book I pick up now I just stop reading it. because of Styron's use of language. It's elegiac, it's lyrical, it's, yeah.
So here's a question. Something which I found sort of distracting when I read the novel was Styron's kind of, I felt, overemphasis of Stingo's libido, like throughout the whole novel. His, not only his fascination with Sophie, but there's this whole long part where he's interested in this woman who's seeing a psychoanalyst, and they have an affair that doesn't turn out so well.
Yeah.
And so then you drew up this naughty evil distinction, and so I'm wondering, is his intention in all that kind of drawn out sexuality to say everything that Stingo is so obsessed with here in reference to his libido really isn't as important to how he grows and develops in this wilderness of wrestling with true evil. So is that kind of him going through this adolescent process and developing into kind of a more mature?
Yeah, I think you've explained it. Your question has given the answer. Yeah, he is, you said more eloquently than I did when I said he just looks at Sophie as a piece of meat. He wants to get her in the sack until, where were you? and he begins to understand the complexity of her personality and what she's been through. But now, as you're saying, he's beginning to understand himself, too. That's all he is in the beginning of the book, right? He's this horny ex-Marine. Did your question give it its own answer, I think?
It makes sense if that was, you know, showing its development, but also trying to put a distinction between kind of naughtiness and evilness, which I didn't think about when I first read it, that was kind of maybe what he was...
My dad's response just comes out of your question, I think. Well, there's a lot of stuff that disturbed me, but the question is, what disturbs us as readers? What disturbs us as Americans? And for sure, he uses a lot of things about the puritanical morality of America in the 40s and the 50s, of what women could wear, how they had to dress. He uses words, he mocks them, like words like petting, masturbation. A metaphor that comes to me out of the novel is that Americans were far more worried about the 14-year-old boy masturbating in the bedroom than they were about what was going on with the Jews in Auschwitz. I mean, what are we focusing on? And what are the big moral questions we have to ask? And I don't think, if you knew him, you know the book, never mind him. We're sure not diminishing the other moral questions by saying, you know, if he's exploiting, as he does, those women, right? Or he tries to. All he wants is to have sex with them. That's immoral. But what else is immoral, and what other questions do we ask? I'm glad you raised it.
So, I mean, I guess that makes more sense when Stingo is talking about, like, his exploits, it's always kind of in this first person, like, I'm doing this and doing that. But when we get the scenes from Auschwitz, it's always in Sophie, it seems. He's recounting what she's saying. So kind of this unspeakable thing which he can't personally experience is in the voice of the one who's actually suffered.
Yeah.
And his kind of adolescent, puerile activities
is
in his person.
Yeah.
So just reflecting on that now, it adds kind of complexity.
Yeah. That's really good, and that's really helpful. You write an essay on that. Stingo, after Sophie and... I mean, he loves Sophie and Nathan. After they commit suicide, he just... It's the first time in his life he can weep. And we know he's a different guy. And he uses the language that's interesting, I think, to us as Christians. But Styron uses this language. He goes down to the beach, and he's just so drunk he passes out. It's the only way he can deal with his sorrows. And some kids come down, and they bury him in the sand. And when he wakes up, this is the language used. He's met all these characters through his life, and he's now crying so hard that it drains out in warm rivulets between my fingers. It was, of course, the memory of Sophie and Nathan's long ago plunge that set loose this flood, but it was also a letting go of rage and sorrow for the many others who during these past months had battered at my mind and now demanded my mourning. At one point, when he's recalling his mother's death, he says, and with my apologies to you, he says, fuck it, and I thought of sex. He didn't want to go there. He couldn't go there to the guilt he felt about his mother until Sophie keeps taking him further and further down into a connection that you've raised beautifully. I'll continue here. But so other characters he's met. Eva, Sophie's daughter, and you know the choice? On the ramp, the commandant or the SS officer says, you may keep one of your children. She says, bitte. You're a Pole, not a Yid. You have a choice. Hurry up, goddamn it, or I'll kill them both. Take my daughter. It's not a choice. It's just a reaction. She has no... So Eva is killed that way. And then Jan, her son, lives, but she says at one point, and I never saw my little boy again. He went to Auschwitz. He doesn't know if he was killed or not. Probably was. Okay. He lists these people. Eddie Farrell, Bobby Weed, my young black savior, Artiste, and Mariah Hunt, and Nat Turner, and Wanda Horch von Kretschmann, who were but a few of the beaten and butchered and betrayed and martyred children of the earth. I did not weep for the 6 million Jews or the 2 million Poles or the 1 million Serbs or the 5 million Russians. I was unprepared to weep for all humanity. This is why the book is about Sophie and all of the intimate assessments of her complex personality. But I did weep for these others, who in one way or another had become dear to me, and my sobs made me an unashamed racket across the abandoned beach. Then I had no more tears to shed, and I lowered myself to the sand on legs that suddenly seemed strangely frail and rickety for a man of 22. This, just what you described, this kid who was a Marine, who was just, and he slept, and then, but when I awoke, it was early morning, his last paragraph. I lay looking straight up at the blue-green sky with its translucent shawl of mist, like a tiny orb of crystal, solitary and serene. Venus shone through the haze above the quiet ocean. I heard children chattering nearby. I stirred. Izzy, he's awake. Go on, you mother's mustache. Screw you. Blessing my resurrection. I realized that the children had covered me with sand, and that I lay as safe as a mummy beneath this fine enveloping overcoat. It was then that I inscribed the words, "It was only morning, excellent and fair." I'm pointing out to the word, what? Resurrection. But we better go home. We're 10 minutes past 9. And I'll talk with anybody who's